Welcome to CYC Podcast Discussions on Child and Youth Care, episode number 100. I'm Wolfgang Vashaw. I'd like to take a moment and say, wow, 100. I'm kind of amazed that we now have 100 podcast episodes up. Thank you to everyone who keeps listening, who shares it with others, who talks to me about episodes, and who suggests ways to make it better. We have people tuning in from around the world, and our listenership fluctuates from about 700 to 1,000 people every month. Thank you to you all. I also want to say a huge thank you to Mike, our editor, as well as Salvatore and Jen, who host Your Right to Speak on the second Wednesday of each month. And finally, thank you to all the guests who volunteer their time to come on and share their knowledge and wisdom. This podcast would not exist if there were not so many people committed to working with children, youth, and families, willing to talk about what they do. And I have one such person with me today. I'm speaking with Sandra Davis. I've been hearing about Sandra for years from different young people I've met. In every sector of child and youth care, there are those who are recognized by young people and colleagues as great at what they do. Sandra is one such person. She's a foster parent who's been loving, caring for, and supporting young women for decades. Thank you for joining me today, Sandra.
Thank you for having me.
You've been a foster parent for many years now. When did you first start inviting people into your home to live with you?
I became a foster parent with Catholic Children's Aid in actually 2001. The funny story to the actual move of, because I was living in Durham region at the time and was scheduled to move into my home now on September 11th, 2001.
Wow.
So it was sort of a very shaky beginning to what's been a great experience for me, but it was, I'll always remember when I started fostering, because it was that day that I was supposed to move, and we ended up moving the next day after everything sort of settled a little bit. But it's a, you know, a reminder every year of sort of when I began this journey.
Indeed. So I was incorrect. It hasn't been decades. It just feels like all the praise has been decades.
Yes.
What motivated you to start fostering?
I think it was a combination of a few things. First off, my grandmother was what you would have called a foster parent. My parents are both from the island of Antigua in the West Indies. It's very common for sort of the seniors or the elders in the community to care for children who maybe can't live at home for whatever reason. So I kind of grew up always meeting and always having people in my life that weren't necessarily biologically related to me, but were considered part of my family. So I always kind of thought in the back of my mind it was something that I would want to do. And then shortly after I had my first, my second child, a boy, my second child, I was introduced to someone who was fostering, and they explained to me, you know, this is something that you could do, and I was really excited, and sort of I went through the process, and kind of the rest is history. It's been 15 and just over 15 years, and it's been a journey. It has been a journey.
I bet it has. What are some of the best aspects of that journey?
Some of the positives is I get to meet all these children who, you know, are in need of support or in need of a place to live or in need of a positive family experience. I get to work with professionals from different disciplines that I wouldn't necessarily have gotten to meet or work with if I had done something else with my life. It has allowed me to expose my children to the world in a different way. So I think it's given me the opportunity for my children to live in a family where they're contributing just by having to share me with others. I think it's been a positive for my kids. It's hard to kind of name all of the positives that come out of fostering. It's it's expanded my family. I am the mother to many daughters now that I would not have if I hadn't chosen to do this. I have grandchildren now that I wouldn't have if I if I hadn't fostered. I have a huge extended family now. It's true what they say, that love multiplies. The more people that you share it with, the bigger it grows. And that is certainly been my experience as a result of being a foster parent.
You must be busy on Mother's Day.
Mother's Day is the bomb.
Busy in all the right ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
You talked about your own upbringing in Antigua and how that motivated you to become a foster parent yourself. What's the response been of your own children to fostering all these different people over the past 15 years?
Well, I was raised here. We came to Canada from England, but my parents were originally, my grandmother was in Antigua. So that was sort of the connection there. But for my daughters were 8 and 6 months when we started to foster. So for my youngest daughter, she's never known anything else. This is what we do, is always been her life. My oldest daughter has developed what she calls her cheetah sisters. So she has connected to a number of young women who have been in my home over the years and adopted them as her sisters. And so there are about 10 or 12 of them that she's connected. So it's just become, this is how our family operates. She's able to, you know, bond with some young women in a way that she considers her sibling, and they're connected for life. There have been young women who, you know, obviously personality and all of those kinds of things prevented them from sort of, you know, making that connection, just the time in the home, or, you know, the just personality clashes, you know, those kinds of things. So my kids have just accepted that this is the way we live our lives. And the decision that we made when we started fostering was, as long as they were happy and it was meeting all of our needs, we would continue to foster. And then on at the time when this was no longer meeting all of our needs, then we would make the decision to stop fostering. So we made the decision to foster as a family, and we make the decision to not foster anymore as a family. And there's been highs and lows. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been huge challenges. My children have accepted that, you know, sometimes my attention can't be focused solely on what they need, that they have to share me. They have to share my attention, my energy, my focus. And they've been very gracious in allowing me to be able to do that. We also try to take some time that it's just the three of us, or mm-hmm. just two of us. Where we go out and we just spend time one-on-one to build that, you know, sort of core bond, because I feel like if that's not really strong, then I can't, you know, give to other kids. But my children, you know, they've had their own personal struggles. I have one daughter who struggles with anxiety. So that's been a challenge to sort of, you know, support her, and also support a number of other young people who come to my home with the same kinds of challenges. Mm. And it's important for her to understand that she's just as important as all the other kids that I bring into my home. But on the flip side, that, you know, what I do for her, I may do something very different for another young person, or encourage a different sort of course of action for another child. So,
indeed, balancing that, you know, the needs of each individual, right? That we're not all the same, right? Just because two people have anxiety, it doesn't mean they're going to respond in the same ways or need the same things,
right? Right.
For sure.
Some of the frustration that comes up sometimes is that the young people that I care for often have access to resources that as a parent in the community of a child, I don't always have access to. So sometimes there's a little bit of frustration with that, where they're able to, if a young person needs counseling, they have they're able to get access to that in a way that as a parent of a child who also needs counseling, it was very difficult. So when we were going through that challenge of finding a counselor, or getting my child into counseling, or getting the assessment done, I struggled where, when I had a foster child who needed that, they seem to be able to get access to some of those services a little more quickly than my child. So that, I kind of struggled with a little bit of that.
Absolutely. And I mean, go ahead.
Yeah. That's just sort of par for the course, with, when you have the access to the resources, it makes, life a little bit more free-flowing. Whereas, yes. as a community member trying to access those services, you struggle, and it's hard sometimes to say to my kids, because of the agency, they get this, and you're going to have to wait because...
that sometimes is a
challenge. It came up with my daughter's wisdom teeth. I've had, over the last 6 to 8 months, I've had two kids who needed to get their wisdom teeth pulled out, and it was like, no problem. And my oldest daughter needs to have hers pulled out, and it's $1,500. And it's can you wait a little bit, yeah. with the other kids? Yeah. It's like, she needs it done, it gets done.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So those kinds of things that, make you kind of take a step back.
And yeah. And really, I mean, it's so indicative of some of the challenges with the social service system in general, right? If these supports existed for young people, obviously not for all young people, but there's some parents, if those supports were in place, the child wouldn't necessarily even need to be in the child welfare system, right? If we had those resources available to parents, we don't have to remove them from the home because we could give the support to the parents.
Absolutely. And I think from my perspective, that's the direction that the agencies are going at this point in time. It's a lot more focused on keeping kids in the home, support in the home, which is great, supporting kin placements, which is also great. And hopefully with that, there will be additional supports to foster parents, because the kids that do end up coming into foster care are really the ones who are, really in need and can't be supported in the home. Mm-hmm. And so therefore the focus can be, okay, so now, we've recognized that this child has, multiple concerns, whether it's conduct disorders or mental health or whatever it is that's preventing them from being in their home. So what kinds of supports can we offer to this foster parent? Because really and truly, if the foster parent has two or three young people in their home, all of whom have, all kinds of diagnoses, they are going to need equal the number of resources that their parents, needed. Right. So they're saying, you can't just take them out of their home and put them in my home and not offer me as much support as you were offering the parent for that child to stay in that house.
Absolutely. Home. Absolutely.
Right. So it's kind of like, because I've got, you know, maybe one, maybe two, maybe three of those kids with multiple issues living in my house, and I happen to be fostering alone, so it's just me. So getting them to doctor's appointments and you know, all of the assessments and counseling and all of those kinds of things, and then dealing with, you know, suspensions and you know, criminal charges and all of those kinds of things, I'm going to need that support to make that all happen yes. for that child in, you know, in my home.
And is your sense that there is a lack of support for foster parents in general? I mean, we're speaking in Southern Ontario. Is your sense that there's a lack of support for foster parents?
I think it's not that there's a lack of support. I think that there's just such a long wait for so many services. Hmm. And so, you know, when you're trying to access children's mental health, there can be a 6 to 8 month wait to get an assessment, you know, when you're calling up whatever service you're calling up. So in the meantime, so unless the child goes into crisis and, you know, has an active plan to commit suicide or whatever, and you can maybe get them admitted into a hospital setting, in which point then, you know, then they would be, you know, offered treatment. You're left to manage. And it's, so I don't think it's necessarily that they're not supporting foster parents, but, you know, if you have a child who is talking about threatening suicide, you know, on a daily basis, how do you manage that in a home with two, maybe three other teens? You know, when they won't keep them in the hospital, because by the time they get to the emergency room and you sit with them for 4 or 5 hours or maybe longer, because I've done overnights where I'm sitting in emergency with a young lady who says, I'm going to throw myself in front of a car, because I'm that sad, or I just don't want to be here anymore. But by the time they've sat in the emergency room with you for 8, 10, 12 hours, and someone comes and sits with them and they have a conversation with that person without you present, they're feeling better. So they send you home. And so then what do you do with that? Because if that child is in a Crown ward, then individual counseling isn't necessarily going to be available to them. Right. They're going to have to go the route of, you know, the community agency. And then you get the children who just, I don't want to go. Yeah. I don't want to deal with it.
Yeah.
So you have this, you know, suicidal child living in your home. And every time they walk out the door, or every time they go in their room, or every time they do anything, you're on edge.
And what would...
How do you deal with that?
Absolutely. How do you deal with that? I mean, emotionally, I you know, having worked with many young people over the years, I'm aware of the emotional toll it takes on me, except I leave them with their foster parents, right? I go home, right? So yeah. I don't, you know, the level of engagement, or, you know, even if I'm working residential, you know, I leave after my shift, and there are staff. So, you know,
and agencies do provide, like, you know, we'll get sort of a back. So we'll get like a wake overnight person. Someone who will sit with that child overnight, but still, like, having that child in your house. I remember many years ago, probably about 8 or 9 years ago, having a young lady, and she was a cutter, and just as I think a variety of issues, and so just even being able to get an assessment done on this, what this young lady's needs were, you know, was something that you had to wait to do. So it wasn't like someone was going to say, okay, let's get her into a psychologist. And the other thing is, she had to agree, because once they're 12, They have to agree to all of this kind, all these kinds of services. So the, she was cutting, you know, she was, and so we started to get really concerned about, you know, what was happening. And I mean, it escalated to where, I mean, I ended up taking, she had a mattress literally on the floor in the room because she was finding all kinds of ways to cut herself and injure herself in her room, that we ended up literally giving her not even the box spring, just the mattress on the floor. And she was literally crawling around the floor looking for staples that she could just, you know, scrape along her skin to injure herself. And we had overnight awakes. I mean, but the whole house was in a turmoil because, you know, I when you have to move everything out of her room, it has to go somewhere.
Absolutely.
So it's not like you could pretend that something's not going on with, you know, Kathy, you know, upstairs when, you know, all of her bedroom furniture is now in somebody else's bedroom or in the hallway and everybody's kind of going, well, what's going on?
Yes.
Right. Absolutely. So it's like, and so it stirs the whole house. So the whole house is on alert. And the agency was, you know, was very supportive in terms of, you know, having wake overnight, but then that's, you know, in a family home where you're trying to create normalcy. And then there's, you know, there's staff coming in every 8 hours to, you know, to, because she couldn't be on her own.
Yeah.
And I mean, eventually she was moved to a more suitable placement. However, you know, it's the toll that's taken on that home, that, you know, that impacts going forward. And it stirs up a lot of things for a lot of kids. You know, when they're seeing someone else kind of go that path, it suddenly, you know, it can trigger, right? It suddenly becomes, well, you know, she said this and this is what happened. Everybody started paying attention to her. You know, all of those kinds of, you know, negative things that, you know, that come about. So there are challenges that, that I don't know that, the system is able to really understand and support us around. I think that the kids that are coming in are more challenging, and that as a group, we keep training, we keep doing all that we can to kind of keep up with it. But I think that fostering as a profession, because I feel like it is, needs to evolve from what it was back in, you know, the 60s and 70s to what it needs to be now in 2017.
And that's based upon the changing demographic of the young people because of these, you know, as you identified, you know, potentially quite positive ways of shifting to, you know, kinship care and, you know, trying to keep young people with families wherever possible and appropriate. You know, it sounds to me like there's absolutely some structural issues that need to change. And you've highlighted some of those. It also sounds to me like, you know, as I know, having met some people that have lived with you, it's about you as a foster parent and the incredible care and love and skills and the thoughtfulness that you bring to the profession. I like you frame it as a profession. If people are considering fostering, what sort of people do you think would be appropriate for this profession?
I think with the level of the skill that's demanded from, I think someone who's got a CYC as their background, social services, even, you know, sort of, I don't want to say, I can't even think of what it would be, like criminal, like, what do they call that when you're working in, with, in terms of, in jail,
like
and,
corrections or
anybody,
criminal justice or
that's it.
Community justice.
Absolutely. Anybody who's kind of done the child development, understands sort of where, you know, what kinds of things kids would need, to sort of survive in the real world and support them in the real world. I think, I'm not saying that people who, you know, are in business and can't be really good foster parents, but I think nowadays there's just so much that you need to know and understand a bit about what's happening for these kids, that someone who's kind of got that as their background would do really well at being a foster parent. I think that fostering sort of the notion that you that it's like mom and dad and 2.5 kids living in a home and having an empty room that wants to, you know, just look after a child can work. However, I really feel like nowadays in Toronto especially, or even in the GTA, anywhere in the GTA, it's really difficult for someone to have an extra room and the time that you need to be able to invest in fostering to be able to foster reasonably. Like really, when you, I was working for a number of years doing recruiting and just trying to get foster parents, to people to become foster parents. And one of the things we used to say is, you know, someone who you need to be financially capable of sustaining your house, but yet still have room in your house to be able to look after, you know, 1, 2, 3 children. And that's not realistic in Toronto. It takes two people to, for most people, to just live in the city. So two people working full time is not something that, you know, not are not going to be able to foster, because it takes, you know, being able to go to plans of care, being able to go to school meetings, to be able to do doctor's appointments and counseling appointments and all of those things, in addition to all the things that become, you need to do as a parent. So, you know, get them to soccer and hockey and, you know, play dates and all of those things that kids just do. So you really kind of need to have, I think, in going forward, people who have chosen social services as their background. And I think that eventually, hopefully, people will start to see that this is something that is a career, is a profession, that people will get paid a salary to be a foster parent. I think right now we, the vision is you do it, what we get reimbursed to care for the kids is not considered an income. So it's you can't rely on it. So it's you know, you might have one child, you might have two, but they may only be with you for a month and then they're gone. So you need to have sort of an income going forward. But that's really difficult to maintain over time if you want to have homes in Toronto. And one of the big things that I know a lot of the agencies are facing is being able to have homes situated in the area where the children are from. There are not enough beds in Toronto for all of the kids in Toronto, so they can stay in their neighborhoods, in their areas, so they can continue in their schools, which they know is, we know is important for kids to be able to have normalcy in their lives. And but now kids, when they get placed, you know, they might be living in Etobicoke, but their placement ends up being in Scarborough. And if they're really motivated and driven, they might be able to get up at, you know, 6:30, leave the house and, you know, journey across Toronto to their high school every day. But it takes, you know, when you've had a traumatic experience or, you know, are living not a great lifestyle, how are you going to have the wherewithal to be able to do that, sustain it over 6 to 8 months?
Absolutely.
Over maybe 2 years.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, there are don't get me wrong, there are kids who've done it. I know kids that do it, but it takes a toll on them, and it impacts how well they do in school.
Mm-hmm. If you're commuting an hour and a half each way, you know, that's time from, you know, for soccer, for hockey, for friends, for homework.
You don't get to do that. You do the basics and, you know, and then people question, well, why do our kids not do as well?
Yeah.
Well, this is why they don't do as well, because, you know, they don't have the social aspect of school. They don't get to really do all of the all of those kinds of things that are going to boost their credibility when it comes to going to post-secondary. And they still have to do, you know, they have to do their plans of care. They have to do the counseling. They have to deal with all of the issues that brought them into care in the first place, on top of trying to do their homework and, you know, and heaven forbid if they have learning challenges or anything else that impacts their education, then it's just another reason why they're, you know, why they're going to struggle. And then heaven forbid that their placement fall apart. And then, you know, and then they end up getting moved again. Or they're going to go home and then, you know, 4 months later they're back in care again, or, you know, it's, there are a number of challenges that that pop up. But then on the flip side, there are so many kids who do so well.
Well, one of the things I wanted to say, I mean, the people I know who've lived with you, you know, sometimes, you know, I remember talking to one person who lived with you, and there had been a research project that I was aware of around the experiences of young people in care, and she said to me, "Oh, I don't think I would give for this project, Wolfgang." It was, you know, arts-based research project. Some really lovely work happened in that project. I don't think I'd be good for this project. I said, "Why not?" And she said, "Well, all my experiences were really good. Like, I don't have any negative stories. I don't have, like, people want to hear the problems. I didn't really have any problems." And I've heard that more than once from young people that live with you, which I think is a real credit to you. Just as we wrap up, because I would just love to end on a positive, loving, caring note. What do you think it is that you bring to foster care that people leave your house? And I recognize this is not going to be every young person's experience, but those who do, they leave your house and they say, "My time in care was really good."
I think one of the first things I say to kids when they come to my house is, "Your time with me starts here." Hmm. I know that you have a past, but I'm not judging you on what your past is. I'm going to judge you on what you do going forward. So if they're coming to my house because they, they had a knockdown, drag out fight with their mother, that got physical or whatever, and that's the reason why they can't be at home, I'm not judging that. Right? We're here, and these are the rules in this house. You know, and let's move forward. Let's build a relationship going forward. I also try to encourage kids to remember that their family is their family regardless. You don't have to spend time with them, but they will always be your family. And so let's move forward but still try to build something. And I want them to have empathy for what happened. I don't want them to necessarily put themselves in that situation and say, you know, "I have to go back," but I want them to understand their parents did the best they could for them and they can move forward, and that family is who you choose it to be. So if you don't want to be part of that family, but you choose to be part of another family, it can be whoever you want it to be. And I try to accept kids for who they are and where they are. And help them to make the best decisions for them going forward, and know that, you know, this house will, and the people here will always be there for them going forward. If you want to pick up the phone and call me, pick up the phone and call me. You know, I will help you if I can. And that if you want positive to come, then you have to put positive out there. So I try to be positive with them as much as I possibly can. Yes, negative things have happened, but if you try to be positive, then you're going to get positive back. I just really, truly have always believed that kids are not disposable. You can't have a kid and then decide you don't want them. And as a society, we can't have kids and then just decide, well, you know, this one's not working out, I don't want them. If you try with them, if you, you know, give them as many opportunities to succeed as you possibly can. I'm not saying I can change every kid. I know that there have been kids who I've had to, you know, throw my hands up and say, you know, I can't do this. They're not in the right place, or they're not ready for what this house means. But I really feel like, you know, kids aren't disposable. You can't just say, no, I don't want them anymore. And so I feel like kids come in the door and hopefully can see themselves being here. And try to get everybody. I'm kind of a peacemaker at heart, so I kind of want everybody to get along. Just get along. So I try to help people find their spot here, and hopefully know that this is always going to be a place that they can be if they want, if they choose to be. It's their choice.
That's beautiful, Sandra. Accept them. Be positive. You know, it's their place, relationship. You know, I think I see why so many people think you do such a lovely, lovely, wonderful job in your profession as a foster parent. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really enjoyed our conversation, as I've enjoyed our conversations in the past, and I look forward to having more conversations with you in the future.
Okay, great. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.